Happy Friday, everyone. Today, Jawhead and I are speaking with Pat Rossum from Curve Labs on building local democratic institutions. Pat has gone deep on DAO design and implementation. We talk about how institutions are built, how to make them more inclusive, and the tension between global economies and local empowerment. The conversation has implications for how we construct companies, but also how more inclusive and vibrant democracies could be realized. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Pat, thanks for joining us today, man.
Thanks for having me.
So we like to kick these things off by just giving you a chance to give our audience a bit of an intro to you as a person. So you don't have to start with, you know, all the Web3 stuff, crypto. You can start wherever you like, go back as far as you like. Give us the story of Patrick.
Now, that's actually a great way to frame that question. And, you know, whenever I'm at some sort of engagement, I sort of like to approach things in that way as well, where it's like, yeah, I don't want to know your LinkedIn. I want to know, you know, what makes you you. And, yes, you know, we can go all the way back, I think.
Let's.
So, yeah, let's do it. Why not? I would say that I grew up on the internet. You know, when I was 6 years old, I was the kid playing AOL chess, you know, on that Windows 98 machine set up in the kitchen that nobody else knew how to take care of. So, nice. Every month I'd be the one, you know, defragging that beautiful machine and getting totally ripped for my mother not being able to speak on the phone because of the AOL chess.
Of course.
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, I would say I was a digital native early on, and that just kept moving with me throughout my life. I went to school at the George Washington University. I studied global economics there, but I actually always wanted to be a graphic designer. So I always wanted to work in Photoshop and do interesting illustration work and this type of thing. And I ended up doing that after school. So I took an econ degree, and I worked in New York City advertising in the entertainment sector. And that was a lot of fun. That was my first career. And that was 4 or 5 years before really just getting tired of it and, you know, getting tired of kind of this vibe of the 9 to 5, this sort of life sucking way of living. And I think we all hit that wall eventually. I think from a very young age, we listen to this institutional narrative. And I know that we're going to like dive into institutions on this podcast. So I want to kind of
do a good frame.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's this institutional narrative that a lot of young people listen to, and I think it used to be true at one point, or it had some element of truth, where you go to the good school and you get the good degree, and then you get picked up by, you know, some consultancy or some good job, whatever that good job may be, and you get the car, you get the marriage, the house, and you die peacefully with a great retirement account because of all these contributions that you made all over your life. And sort of this narrative of stability. Now it's a bit of a flex by the boomer class, right? Like it's not.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not true. It's not the least bit true. It's, you know, my girlfriend, she recently got out of school, master's degree, and it, great school, kind of following this narrative. And so many of her peers are just like, where are the jobs? You know, what's going on here? And of course, they can do free internships wherever, but it's not the same job market that used to exist. And it's not the same sense of stability. And so this is good, though, in my opinion. Like, this is kind of revealing, like, sort of the institutional cracks. And I've lived my entire life, you know, kind of scratching that itch, trying to put myself in those cracks and really widen that crack in a certain way. I think that's been my career the last 5 years, is sort of identifying these opportunities to maybe acquire some escape velocity and move through that crack in a really meaningful way with a tribe of people. That's not just myself. So anyway, got tired of that life, YOLO'd all my savings into Ethereum pretty early on. That was it was an interesting decision because I saw, you know, this going on Reddit. It must have been January 2017. And
yeah,
I was in a place of desperation. I had gone to one of the most expensive schools in the US. I had accumulated, you know, the typical school debts narrative. And I was really working as hard as I was working to pay that off. And I had about $4,000 of savings that I actually had inherited from my mother. So my mother had bought $100 worth of stock in a bank when I was born. And through multiple stock splits and just the beauty of finance, that had turned into something like $4,000 by the time I was in my mid-20s. And I just put all of that in ether about 48 hours after first reading about it. Because when I discovered this thing, I thought to myself, going back to that digital native past, going back to being 6 years old, playing AOL chess, I fell in love with the technology kind of right off the bat, because I saw a crack. I saw an opportunity, not for me as an individual at that time. So there was no tribe, there was no sort of group dynamics there, nor sort of institutional vision or desire to reframe the institutional. It was just a crack for me. And that actually did help me move past the life that I had. I was able to leave my work. I became, there's this joke in New York City where you're too poor to move away from New York City just because of the cost of leaving. Yeah. And I was able to leave New York City. I was able to travel for 6 months. At that time, I worked as a researcher for a group of angels in the blockchain space. I was doing research on various tokens and creating these reports, and really just in retrospect, getting everything wrong, but having a great time doing it. And
nice.
I think that's the place anyone should start. If they want to get involved in crypto economics or governance design or any of that, go study 50 other projects and really understand what they did, understand the mathematics of what they did, understand the design decision-making, and start to build this mental model of what good tokenomics or what good governance or what good platform design really entails.
Yeah, for sure. It's not an easy problem. There are multiple vectors of space that have to be addressed at the same time, and all of them have trade-offs.
All of them have trade-offs. Even the ones that we think don't, there's counterfactual costs that are embedded in whatever's going on. And for those of folks who aren't aware of what the term counterfactual means, it just means, you know, what would have happened if the thing that happened did not happen, if we had taken kind of a different path, you know, and we could say opportunity cost as well. That's a term from economics that kind of fits in that vein as well. But to make a long story short, I got picked up by the DAO Stack project in early 2018. This was one of the earliest DAO frameworks on the Ethereum blockchain. I ended up being very heavily involved kind of as a representative of the DAO Stack team, kind of involved in the Genesis DAO, which was their DAO pilot, and what I like to call the first functioning DAO pilot on Ethereum. There was one before, but it never reached the governance stage, so I don't think it's very meaningful. There was a paper put out on the Genesis DAO, great research retrospective, I believe by the P2P Foundation. And I always sort of point folks that way to take a look at it and like really understand like how many mistakes were made in 2018, 2019, 2020, the early days, if you will.
Nice.
I left DAO Stack February 2020. I started my own outfit, you know, with my colleague, Mr. Chem Dagdalan. He actually had been working on the Aragon project, which was another early DAO framework. And by our powers combined, you know, it's like that Super Saiyan meme.
Yes, by our powers combined. You spirited Curve Labs into existence. Is that the by your powers combined?
Yes, we created this thing, and it's a very lovely thing. I think I never imagined that I would be the person in charge of the things that I'm in charge of, because I've always been more of a lone wolf than a leader. And I've been eating more and more at this idea that, you know, there's this saying, right? If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to make it far, move together. And now I'm learning what it means to move together. And I think that's something that's good to learn, especially at the stage of life I'm at, because When you get older, you get tired, you know, you don't have as much energy to kind of...
Tell me about it.
Yeah. The pain that you feel, you start asking yourself, is this permanent? rather than sleeping it off. So I'm starting to get it now. I'm starting to understand why we bring on associates, friends, colleagues, you know, how they help us build a village and what a village means at the end of the day.
That's a really good segue, actually, because I think that you're one of the few people in the space who I think already immediately got this idea that institutions can be created out of these things that we call blockchains, right? So like that one of their most interesting use cases is creating institutions. I think it's one of the first things we talked about. So I think going from this bridge or bridging from this village metaphor into the conceptual space of institutions, maybe you could tell us a bit, you know, I've seen you give a few talks on this at Celo Connect. That's really one of the things that, you know, Celo Connect being one of them, and you're really focused on this, I believe. Even if you go to your Twitter profile, there's just a little thing there that says create institutions. You couldn't have said it in a more succinct way, right? So maybe you can tell us a bit, what is an institution, right? Let's get into the meat of, for folks who don't know, what is an institution?
Starting with the hard questions, huh? let's take this really complex assemblage and just try to boil it down. No, there's a lot of definitions of institutions, but for me, I like to take kind of a network perspective on what an institution is. And an institution is, you know, it's human-based, in my opinion. I don't think non-human life really have institutions at the level that humans have institutions. I see it as, you know, sitting in the center of a network or central to a network and sort of self-propagating that network, either as sometimes as a rent seeker, if it's a little bit of an older institution, it's sort of think of something like a university. You know, a university is really a real estate investment company that, you know, takes tuition as a rent-seeking behavior and then moves that tuition into real estate and then has established sort of this place in the network where it can continue to, you could use the term exploits, but build its wealth through this particular strategy. So institutions tend to be self-propagating, in my opinion. Institutions come in a lot of different forms. Institutions can be biased towards the economic. You can have monetary policy-making institutions such as the central bank, or you could have something like a sovereign wealth fund, like they do in Norway, the institution of retirement. You know, this is something very popular in the US. You look at Fidelity, and Fidelity is an institution. It has it affects our lives. It affects the lives of many, many people. And again, it's self-propagating. You know, Fidelity has a business model here where it's presenting a narrative of how retirement works, on how you will be kept safe in your old age. And this is what institutions do. They define stages of life and they offer for each stage of life a particular service or a particular way of being that really cuts into the core of each and every person who participates in that institution.
Got it. And so now, you know, there's not just you in the space, by the way. We've had a few people on the pod who've also really dig into institutional design, you know, adaptive governance, these kinds of things. So common stack folks, token engineering, these folks as well. Now that you've kind of set the stage for institutions, one other thing that you've hearkened on, which I think is really interesting, is this idea of programmable institutions that, you know, you basically like DAOs are essentially programmable institutions. So digging into that a bit, why are DAOs? No, I'm kidding. That's way too much of a, that's too general of a question, but it's really more like programmable institutions and DAOs. Why do we have them? Why is this something people should pay attention to, right? Because we've had, as you said, you pointed out universities or institutions, these old financial, these monolithic financial entities are institutions. Why do we have to care about institutions becoming programmable and popping up in the Web3 space? What's the promise, in your opinion?
I think you can really go to first principles there. And you can look at society as information society. And every institution has a corpus. It has a corpus of memory. where it understands what happened in the past. And in many cases, it can exploit this information that it's aggregated. It can do sort of an arbitrage between what it knows and what folks attracted to this institution know and understand. And that offers it an advantage in society. Well, that offers many institutions an advantage. One great example of this sort of like informational arbitrage, going back to Fidelity, is this narrative of what retirement is supposed to be. Even if this narrative is not true, even if we can confront the reality of more truthful information, such as the climate crisis is actually going to make retirement very difficult for everyone our age, this institution is not interested. And this institution has such a foothold in society and such an ability to arbitrage its positioning, that this second narrative, which is the more honest narrative of the climate crisis, is not able to get any meaningful foothold. So every institution has a corpus. And what makes programmable institutions so exciting is, let's say in the Web3 space, is that this corpus is known and can be made known to everyone around you through transparency and through functionality such as the interoperability, the composability that Web3 provides. You're not only building a single corpus, you're building a network of corpuses, corpi.
Yeah, that's a good one. We can look this up for the show notes. Be like, Latin, what is the right plural for corpus?
But yes, it's like on. Octopus, you know, like what's yeah. going on there?
Yeah, exactly.
And that interoperability is just so critical to everything that's going on right now in the governance space. When we look at going back to the climate crisis, when we look at the types of institutions that are trying to mediate the climate crisis, they're relatively siloed. They're developing their own methodologies for, you know, verifying ecological state and change of state. These methodologies are not always compatible. These methodologies are collecting data that is not being shared in any meaningful way. And this is preventing, as a society, from building a corpus, from building a single truth, a single informational archive from which our models, our methodologies, our ways of being, you know, our epistemology essentially can reference as being that single source of truth. And what makes Web3 so exciting, what makes blockchain so exciting, is we are building that single source of truth. We are building a corpus that can be referenced by these programmable organizations universally all around the world at any time. And anyone has access to it to an extent, depending on how your APIs are structured. But let's just say that people have access to these things. And what does that tangibly mean? Like, it means that this arbitrage is made horizontal, it's flattened. It means that monetary institutions, which previously had a monopoly on economic policy, on financial protocols, on interest rates, these types of things, they no longer do. They no longer do. And, you know, that's the programmable money narrative. That's what cryptocurrency is. And that's a great first use case, because money is so ubiquitous. It's like breathing, right? But now with the programmable institution narrative, it's sort of comes down to the reduction in transaction costs for setting these things up, for accessing and leveraging the information in this global corpus, being so low that, yes, you can conceivably create a university. Yes, you can conceivably create something that resembles the state in a lot of ways, if not is the state, depending on the social choice mechanism that you choose to integrate into such the governance of such a programmable organization. Yes, you can have all these things. And that, to me, is very exciting. Today, we are going through a period of organizational design, of innovation in organizational design, that we have not experienced since the creation of the joint stock company, of the East India Trading Company.
That's literally something I've said word for word before, like a few years ago. So that sometimes it's kind of eerie to me to hear it come out of another person's mouth in the same way. That's a really good point. And I think when you talk about these programmable institutions, this is like the bull case for it, right? Where you have like, hey, we have now this design space of things that we can begin to tinker with, and they don't have to happen under the purview of some larger institutional space, right? Or what have you, right? We can actually build these for ourselves. So then taking, if I looked at it, you know, from a little bit more of a skeptical side, I'm not actually prone to, but hey, here we are, here I am, right? So
let's steel man the opposition, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So we have these institutional problems. They're well described, right? Some of them have been just kind of put together in Coasean terms. There are other things like the iron law of bureaucracy, but eventually people kind of go like, well, you know, it's the best we have and we need to improve them. So taking that side, right? Like, the institutions, we put hundreds of years into them. They're Lindy, right? So Lindy being like, essentially, the longer they've been around, the more likely they are to be around, right? The Lindy effect. Why do we need to address these with programmable institutions, right? Why can't we just improve the ones that exist?
So capitalism, as it exists today, has sort of this imperial hubris that it has this quality where it doesn't just defeat, you know, counter movements to itself. It absorbs them. It absorbs them. It commodifies them. It takes something like an Occupy Wall Street or a BLM, and it brings it into itself. And that is why it is such a successful global system, because it absorbs and it sterilizes any sort of revolutionary impulse against itself. And in a lot of ways, it also has technologies which are designed to neutralize such affect, whether you look at Netflix or, you know, the entertainment is television is having its best years ever. Every year, television gets better. In fact, the amount of programming that's available.
Yeah.
We are living in not even a renaissance of cinema, just like a Cambrian explosion of
right.
cinema. And have we ever really stopped to think what these technologies are really doing? Yeah, they are taking our attention. They are taking our libido. They are neutralizing any sort of anger, legitimate anger, legitimate protest that we may have against the system that we live under. And this is a fundamental quality of the system that we live in. So why not just improve on the institutions that we have? You know, why put forward the strategy of building alter economic spaces or building, you know, these completely different things? And to me, the answer is to avoid the capture that working with the institutions as they exist would entail. I think we've seen where this path leads. I think we see what greenwashing means. We see what happens when regulatory capture occurs, as it has occurred in the US, is occurring in the EU, where you have gas and oil companies setting policy. You have, you know, in the US, you've had a Christian minority seize the government, seize the judicial branch of government. And they are now stripping away the rights of women and forcing this sort of ethno-fascist way of being on a population of close to 350 million people. So these institutions, they are weak, they are easy to capture because they are poorly designed. And in the event that there is a legitimate movement against them, that movement is instrumentalized to the benefit of such an institution. Look at Pride Month.
Look, geez. Yeah.
Like, you want a great example of capture? You have what, Coca-Cola waving a pride flag? You know, it's insane. Like, do these things like really link to each other? Not really. This is just, again, I mean, Oreo was the most absurd. I think there was a LGBT Oreo pack that was put
nice.
Out. And are you joking? Like, are you serious?
Yeah.
Like, this is insane. And
we Nabisco this month wish you, we have partnered with, so, you know, the meme completes itself, right? So
yeah
totally.
We now cut for an advertising break and then you talk about your Pride Month cookies.
Yes, excellent. Cool. All right. So the reason I asked that is because, you know, a lot of what you talk about in the work that you've done in socio-ecological systems, in thinking about this notion of cyber-physical systems and design spaces, it's, you know, it's interspersed throughout all of the language and thinking you've already kind of put on display here, right? So what I think is most interesting is that, you know, in projects like Collectivo and other things that you're working on, you know, maybe Toucan and what have you, is what has hitherto not really, I guess you could say, it's been done in a kind of a bumbling, ham-fisted way, is with these institutions that exist. You know, you mentioned verification, you mentioned making certain things transparent, right? ecological and natural capital, right? It's kind of the next thing that I'd want to touch on, because these institutions that exist, right, they kind of sit there and say, well, you know, Vera has been, like, I think it's since 15th or 20th year. I think it was made in the late 90s, formed, right, originally around the commands markets and what have you. So Vera and other institutions that are trying to make ecological natural capital a thing, right? From your perspective, and honestly, I share much of this, I'm going to complete some thoughts here. This is your opportunity to say, like, no, I don't disagree. I disagree with that. You're putting words in my mouth, right? So if you come at this from an institution that ostensibly can be captured, is not built in an anti-capture way, has kind of just been spirited into existence for a particular purpose, but is not really equipped to meet that purpose, I think in some ways you get Vera. And I'm not trying to pick on those guys. They do great work. They do the best with what they can, right? But we're now kind of extending the space of existing institutions into places where either things were too complex for them to be managed by an institution. I'm talking about basically ecosystem services and, you know, ecologies and all these other things that are quite complex when you try to break them down in either in outputs, inputs, or anything else, and then say, hey, let's actually build an institution to manage this, manage what per se, right? Like, that kind of ends up being, that's one of my theories for why this thing is the way it is, right? But we're now at this point in 2022, especially in this refi movement, things like Collectivo, where people are like, we need to take, you know, ecological economics and all these other sort of heterodox schools, and we need to put them to work with ecological and natural capital, right? So when I say put them to work, that means, you know, to me, taking what you said about programmable institutions and applying them to new forms of capital. So the one thing I wanted to ask you here is, you know, I'm sitting in the audience, and this happened to me in April and before that as well, when you were giving your talk, and just say, like, why do we need to make a new form of capital? You know, like, we already have money, you said, right? It's everywhere. Why do we need to capture natural capital? What is the bull case for you? Why are you thinking about this?
So we need to look at the fundamentals of exchange in society. And we have this double coincidence of wants, right? Where I have three oxen, you have a chicken, and I want to buy half a chicken or something like this. So we need some fungible means of exchange. We need something that can be broken down into constituent parts that allow us to reach an agreement, which is a fair agreement between the two of us. And that's why we created money, right? So that we can, like, solve this problem. But when I say we created money, I mean that an institution created money. I mean that there was some, you know, Mesopotamian king or what have you, who said, you know what, we are going to have fungibility. It's just going to be copper coins with my face on them. And boom, money is born. So capital in the form of let's say, a spending currency or a currency that is meant to be traded, this has existed for a long time. And this has needed to exist because it solves a fundamental issue that we all need to be solved. Now, looking at the evolution of money and the way that institutions issue money, at a certain point, we exited sort of this metal standard and we started fiat-based central banking. And yeah, you know, we said, okay, so we're going to have some collateral, usually a bond or a treasury asset, and we are going to create, you know, spending currency from this collateral. And that's, you know, that's a common story. But the other part of this story is actually very geostrategic. It's, okay, we are going to have this currency, but the access to oil is going to be exclusively denominated in this currency called the US dollar. And so now the dollar, you know, we understand it as the petrodollar, right? So now the dollar, it's sort of like a bonding curve with an access token. And that token everyone wants because they want to be able to access some platform, right? Of course, that token is going to keep its value versus every other token because, you know, it has monopolized access to highly concentrated energy, right? And this was a brilliant strategic move because money is not only about a means of exchange, it's about a means of access. It's about, where can you spend your money And other folks will keep that money and not exchange it out themselves. That is how money keeps its value against other monies. It is a relative phenomena. It is a mechanism that exists at the international level. And we understand that the international, according to an International Relations 101 course, the international exists in a state of anarchy. So everything is relative to each other in such a global state. So, you know, accepting all of this means that we are accepting the hegemony of a particular institution, the institution that issues dollars. We are accepting this hegemony because this institution has the most access to global energy reserves, which is actually a form of natural capital. Oil is a form of natural capital at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So our system, as it already exists, is based off access to a very particular natural capital. So once we understand this is the case, that we have this global institution with a monopolized access to energy, we can start to deconstruct this. And we can start to say, well, listen, why can't we have more localized institutions who then, you know, back their currency with access to the abundance that they create through their natural capital assets or their ecosystem assets or what have you? And this is just acknowledging the power dynamics as they already exist and reformulating them at a different scale with different natural capital assets. And if we do not do this, going to the counterfactual, which actually is reality today, that global institution will go in, will use their authority to extract the riches of various territories in order to, you know, produce products or to deepen its own pockets and so forth. And is this not the behavior of U.S. corporations when they go into Chile and they get exclusive mineral rights to extract the mountaintops of Chile that we then turn into iPhones at the end of the day, destroying the ecosystem there in order to fuel our commodity desires in the US? Is that not already what's going on? This sort of dynamic of these corporations going out and doing quite a bit of extraction from places where institutional protections do not exist at a local level? Like, this is the world as it exists. So if we want to change this world, we must change the scale in which we are operating, in which our institutions are operating. We must change the controllers of those institutions to be locally sourced. And this is, you said something before, you said managing the complexity of something, I think it was nature or what.
Yeah.
They're very difficult for an institution to do, but there are principles for doing this, you know.
Patrick, what would you do in the circumstance where the skill set isn't available locally?
I don't believe that's true, because we have had indigenous peoples for thousands of years manage the entirety of the earth. They have the skill sets.
Well, I'll give an example, right? So when this Iraqi dissident moved to Norway and set up, essentially worked over the past 50 years or so to set up how the institution of the Norwegian kind of sovereign wealth fund was created and built a lot of wealth. I mean, this is one of the reasons why the average Norwegian citizen is richer than every other citizen in the world. They invited in the oil majors because they didn't have the skill set to actually manage internally, but they still were able to guarantee that the governance and ownership rights remained with the citizens and the people of Norway, right? So this dichotomy, I'm just not sure I buy into. And so, you know, I think
articulating a complete dichotomy. And I appreciate this challenge. I appreciate this provocation. So let's understand, you know, some of the dynamics of my own company. You know, like, let's understand, like, what is Curve Labs doing? Curve Labs is designing and developing an institutional system, which is going to now be applied on the island of Curaçao. Now, are we retaining any of the governance rights? Are we retaining any power over the local? No, we are not. We are coming in as a service provider, the same way that these oil companies came in as service providers. We are articulating a system, and we are letting the people there use such a system. And this is good, in my opinion. This is good in that, you're right, this is not a dichotomy. This is not local versus global. This is about creating paths for collaboration, creating paths for mediation between the two, where the global does not subsume the local, but there's still advantages to having it exist. There's still advantages to, you know, it being able to provide such services, such acumen, such skill sets. This is why I articulate in my own writing the need for global collaborative networks, you know, the sort of these interfaces and these collaborations between actors who may exist in a traditional colonial state, such as the states in Europe or, you know, somewhere like the US, and some of these places where these institutional systems have not existed or have been deconstructed by oppressors for whatever reason, who now need something built, something deployed, something available for them to use to their own purposes.
Yes, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think one of the challenges of this kind of framework that you're elaborating, and I agree kind of ideologically with a lot of it, is that the institutional economics literature, I think, has fairly demonstratively shown that it takes time to build institutions. And it's, as we've talked about with Richard Bartlett and others, it's a muscle that has to be built within individuals. And so to the extent that there isn't kind of an internal capacity, everyone has voice, everyone has kind of opinions, everyone has the capacity for that, right? But when you get into hard skills of managing ecosystem services, I guess where I might kind of be a little hesitant to say that everything needs to go local is that in a lot of situations where we've devolved complete control locally, it's led to some of the worst outcomes in terms of democracy, right? Because you effectively didn't have the ability for the local population to manage the resources within that environment without external support. This is something that, to the extent the audience is interested in, it's something that Paul Collier has written a lot about in Plundered Planet, where he kind of prescribed a way of thinking about how do we deal with Dutch disease in emerging markets and what are the institutional frameworks that we can create to help local governments or local actors to better manage Dutch disease. So I just wanted to interject there, but not throw us too far off, because I hear a lot of this and I think, well, there are a lot of kind of cases of where another example would be, I forget which country in South Africa worked with De Beers, right? Where they essentially invited in De Beers Botswana and essentially said, we're going to own 50% of the diamond trade and you're going to own 50% of the diamond trade. And it was really good from a development perspective for Botswana. So I'm not sure that we need to devolve everything to a local level and essentially not utilize skill sets that have been built over decades or generations or centuries in order to inform and to support local populations and better managing local resources to the benefit of those local populations, both in this generation and in future generations.
The only thing I would add is, why not both?
Well, sorry, I think that's what most of these, yeah, I think that's the key here is that I think we absolutely need both, right? But the idea that we can have a complete kind of devolvement, I think sounds a little bit like going against, I mean, it almost sounds like we're moving away from everything we've learned from kind of globalization over the past 30 or 40 years and why it's so important that there's trade and why it's so important that there's specialization. And maybe that's not what you're saying here at all, Patrick, but that's kind of, I wanted to kind of interject and get your thoughts on that because it was coming up for me as you were speaking.
That's not at all what I'm saying. So first we have to understand that there is a design tension between the local and the global, and that there are, you know, certain actors that have more power on the ground than other actors. And I'm saying that the resolution of this tension due to globalization has resolved in favor of the global generally. And I am saying that a movement back towards the local is a useful movement. A movement back towards the local is useful in the context of, in a twofold context. First, when it comes to adaptation, when it comes to being able to navigate the 21st century, the era of long crisis, which we are just now starting or have started already, in my opinion, local anti-fragility needs to be established. You cannot have entire areas where people are not capable of self-governance in situations where they absolutely need it. And they need that coordination acumen in order to survive. Because when those people don't have it, they migrate. When those people are not able to self-organize, they move And that mass movement of people causes a lot of conflict today. It causes, and it's going to keep causing more and more conflict as certain parts of the earth become unlivable without this level of adaptive capacity, right? So articulating such a movement back to the local is not saying that everything must be relocalized. It is saying that there are great benefits. There are benefits that are needed at this point in time from just a purely survivalist perspective for many of these communities that are missing because they do not have the local acumen that they need to be building for themselves.
And what do you think is the mechanism whereby those that are in power, and we could speak about this from a government perspective, or because, you know, I think the mining example in Chile is really a really good example where you have an expropriation of assets. I mean, under capitalism, we wouldn't call it that, but under other kind of frameworks, we would call it that, by kind of global capitalist companies taking resources that probably should belong to local peoples. What is the mechanism by which you believe that power dynamic should shift? Because I think we can all get on board with, if everything was localized, right, that would probably be better, right? Because effectively you would have people that were vested in ownership and governance on the ground. I think there's very few people that would argue with the benefits of that. But how does the power dynamic evolve?
The power dynamic evolves by, you know, in my, what I have been working towards, which may not be the best path. You know, there are, you know, folks, philosophers, you know, people who articulate kind of, okay, these things are only going to shift when crisis reaches a point that forces such a shift. And the accelerationist argument is, let's instigate crisis faster, right? Like that is the mechanism that is put forward with many folks. I am a little more muted personally. You know, my argument is, you know, let's change the institutional dynamics. Let's build these things ourselves. Is it going to take more time? Absolutely. Is it difficult? Absolutely. Is everything going to work everywhere? No. But we can start today. You know, the sort of like idea of planting a tree and, you know, 7 generations later, we have a beautiful forest. That is sort of what I am working towards in the ideology that I subscribe to.
I think it's really powerful. And I think it's also kind of, it's been shown kind of to be pragmatic as well, right? I mean, the accelerationist, just so people understand, like it is predominantly, I'm not actually sure what the ideological bent is in the EU and the US. It's a far right movement that is kind of tied to provoking. I mean, a lot of the folks that were behind January 6th were kind of accelerationists, where you essentially provoke a crisis and that crisis leads to a downfall or to kind of an inflection point where things can actually change. I just finished Barbara Walters' book, How Civil Wars Start. And one of the things that was really powerful about it was her way of documenting kind of democratic institutions on a spectrum. She used kind of this, or the way that people think about kind of democratic institutions and the vibrancy of them in some sociological literature, looks at the scale of negative 10 to plus 10, and then looks at factionalism of kind of a scale of 1 to 5. And she essentially documented how the US has gone from a plus 10 to kind of a 5 over the course of the last 10 years. So it's really now an anocracy, or somewhere between an autocracy autocratic and democratic design. But one of the things that she talked about it, and I would recommend, you know, particularly the third and fourth, or the penultimate and kind of the last chapter for people that are interested in this, is the only way that you can have, I think, the vision that you're articulating outside of violent conflict is if those in power essentially cede control. And one of the examples that she gave was when William de Klerk, why the Nobel Prize Committee kind of gave both Mandela and William de Klerk the Nobel Prize, because effectively there was no way for Mandela, or it would have been much harder, I guess is a better way to put it, for Mandela to rise unless that room was created by de Klerk. And there was a huge outcry against this, because they were like, well, why was this person who was part of kind of an apartheid government given a Nobel Prize? But her philosophy was where civil wars start, where you have this tension that leads towards violence, is when you have an incumbent population that is losing power and can't figure out how to kind of be involved in this new system and is worried about kind of the rights of the minority. So, and that doesn't go to say anything against what this vision of wanting to devolve power to local populations. I just think that one of the things that I think about a lot at the firm level is how do we do this in a way that's actually competitive from a strategy perspective, where these new firms can compete effectively with existing firms that have really strong leadership teams. So how does a new kind of decentralized firm compete with a team that has kind of a dictatorial control? And then at the macro level, which I think is more along the lines around of what you're talking about, how do we do this in a way that doesn't lead to conflict? So how do we figure out how to empower more people where you don't have a dynamic, which is occurring in the US, where, you know, and this is not a philosophy I agree with at all, but I think it's the philosophy that 40% of the population believes in the US, where they're losing control. And their only way of kind of dealing with that is to essentially say, we're going to elect people that are going to exclude people from, we're essentially going to deny rights to a bunch of people because we don't want to lose control. So I don't have an answer to this, but kind of the conversation has kind of reflected some of the things that I've just been reading over the past 48 hours. And so wanted to bring them up.
Yeah, it sounds like I provoked some pretty tasty thoughts there.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Thank you.
which was great because, like, you know, we encourage some of the spiciness here, to be honest, because we do have our friends on. But like at the end of the day, I don't know, you know, I think for the most part, most of us are very much aligned with what you called, you know, kind of exploiting these cracks between what institutions are, you know, kind of managing, right? Finding your places in those cracks and making space, right? And it's just about at the end of the day, how you do it, right? Like, and the trade-offs that come with that, because there's always trade-offs.
And, you know, there is sort of this this locus of control discussion that needs to happen in terms of, do we actually have like any agency to meaningfully impart these sorts of systems upon the world? And if we don't, you know, that implies that we should just be partying into the good night. You know, we should be enjoying yes. such a decline. And, you know, I know folks, I have colleagues who sort of like take that perspective, kind of your ultra doomerism, if you will. And, you know, we have to understand that the very nature of us being here today and having these discussions versus living on an island and partying every night is that we have sort of like in our way of being, in our way of practice, decided that we're not going to opt for that sort of like form of existence, that we are going to have conversations about ways that we can navigate these cracks, ways that we can expand them, with the belief at the end of the day that some part of the future sits within me or sits within you or sits within the communities that we're building. And I would perhaps be a little bit more optimistic or a little more optimistic compared to let's say more cynical folks that we can impart ourselves upon the world in some way.
I think that's a good spot to turn to our final topics, having these things sort of all of these patterns we've been speaking, how they materialize and what is becoming, I guess the meme is now gaining a foothold, regenerative finance and Web3, ReFi, right? So I think, you know, Martin hinted at this a little bit. I think you have definitely butted up against it in all of your talks. There's this great little diagram you pulled from Hatfield Dodds 1998 around adaptive governance, right? So I think for those, you know, this pod's focus is very much on the new forms of governance that are the governance design spaces that are being enabled by some of these technologies, and then what results in terms of wealth distribution and other forms of distribution. You know, obviously, you know, just when we talk about wealth, we talk about mostly, you say that's someone else, money, right? Accumulation, right? But there's other forms of distribution as well, right? So especially when you go from the global to the local, and the further you localize, maybe you're not going to localize in an abstraction, you localize in maybe something pegged to a local currency or what have you, right? Maybe a natural currency. So coming back around to this idea of adaptive governance, in my opinion, one of the reasons why we see institutional failure, particularly with regards to climate change, is that you're seeing a bunch of global actors where it's really, really difficult for them to collaborate at cross scales, right? Across this global to local and then across the globe. So you mentioned you passed super lightly on this in your talk. And I wanted to just dig in on adaptive governance and ask you, like, how do you see this notion of adaptive governance across institutional economics, agricultural and resource economics, ecological economics, and the humans, the human ecologies that are being governed? How do these ideas of adaptive governance really come to the fore for you in ReFi and Collectivio? What does it actually mean?
So first, we kind of need to articulate what adaptive governance is. And adaptive governance has many components. You know, there is this component of co-management, you know, where different members of the community, of a community existing at different scales, are determining how a landscape, how a territory exists. You know, what does the management of such a territory look like? What is this land used for? You have this idea of collective memory, and whether it's something like elder consultation to understand how to navigate the poor harvest, or something like a blockchain database, where we are literally storing ecological state and temporal changes of states to build a better understanding of the present, as well as a predictive analytics of the future. You have this component of polycentrism, and I sort of touched on that as well. You know, adaptive governance is never a single organization in isolation. There are multiple layered organizations, all co-managing the same territory, all participating in the same ecosystem. So there are these elements of, I suppose, human ecology here. There are these elements of institutional design and sort of the social economic component there. And all of this is just kind of coming together to sort of like answer the question of how do we build more adaptive institutions? And adaptation sort of being how well can we navigate and maintain a baseline stability for the human and non-human actors that live in a particular territory. And I think ReFi has a really strong potential to be meaningful here, in that ReFi consists of many overlapping and parallel technologies that really fit into the needs of good adaptive governance design. First, you literally have governance technologies. You have very practically things like the Gnosis Safe and the Zodiac Suite, which allows you to articulate a control surface for an institution that can have any sort of social choice mechanism for the determination of how that surface is formulated, right? That is extremely powerful. That goes all the way back to when we were talking about programmable organizations. You have the economic component, and that economic component, you know, essentially you can issue these objects we call tokens, and they can be issued in the cutting edge part of adaptive governance of ReFi is that these, the issuance of these tokens, the tokenomics of these objects can be linked to the underlying material reality. You could have a token that is contingent on, let's say you have an elastic supply token, and the supply of that token is contingent on the meters squared of some area which is being stewarded by groups on the ground. And if you want to mint more of that token, you then have to claim an area and, you know, get that area to a particular ecological state and provide proof, provide verification that has reached such a state. And then there's this certification process where then tokens are issued to your group relative to the area in which you have improved. And that directly links the financial layer to the underlying material reality. And that those are the links that we need to explore today. Those are the links that, you know, we can think of the carbon offset or the carbon credit market as being like the most primitive attempt at something like this, where we don't necessarily have full automation. We have auditors that are, you know, stamping these documents provided by the various governments that saying, oh yeah, we can serve this part of the forest with very little sort of monitoring, reporting, or verification applied to this process. With ReFi, I imagine something more cybernetic in essence. I imagine, you know, automating these participatory IoT and remote viewing inputs to really just, and ascribing the ecological state or change of state to a particular actor, which is functioning in some territory. And then, you know, the wealth that is created by the regeneration, by the restoration, conservation that is going on for this particular area is flowing to the people who created it, or some part of it. You know, imagine we have some sort of smart contract, which is splitting the distribution of tokens. Maybe some part of it is going to a financier class. I think that's not bad. I think we should actually be financing thousands of these types of institutional seeds around the world, which do attempt to conserve or restore the ecological state or change of state for some territory. But for the most part, the people creating, the people who already create the benefits that a territory produces, whether they're ecosystem assets or services or what have you, and can prove that they're doing so. And imagine that we can automate such proof, which I hope one day we'll be able to get to. That is what ReFi should aim to become, in my opinion. You know, merging the ecological, the economic, the governance design, and creating this sort of like holistic system. When I think of ReFi on a global scale, I think of our underlying material reality, our physical reality, being a layer, a meat space layer, and then sitting on top of that being sort of this virtual global economic layer that is responding to real-time physical shocks with different distributions of liquidity so that the institutions on the ground can respond accordingly to the shocks that they're experiencing, so that the institutions on the ground can take particular territories and restore them to the ecological state that is desirable. That this is sort of we can get really crazy here, right? Like we can say the next sort of like evolution of Gaia as system is the integration of these technical artifacts that man is creating, called money, called collateral, called finance, integrating this layer with the crust, with the biosphere, with these other layers that already exist. And then, building sort of these mediations between the two. That is what ReFi, I hope, has the ambition to achieve, even though we're sort of just in the present, we're dealing with a very early mimetic world where there's a lot of hopium and there's a lot of, there's sort of a lack of proof. There is a lack of change in the underlying ecological states, but things have to meme themselves into existence, right? Like that is how we reach the actualization of a thing. You have that, what's that curve that like Deloitte publishes where you have this big hype cycle and then sort of a dip?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that says we are here or whatever, yes. Right? Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. We're in a speculatory hype cycle. And the important thing to remember is that after the dip, we just got to keep going on and developing such technology as well as we can all around the world, with those communities which are most open to it.
Got it. And then going back to the original thing around adaptive governance, it sounds like you're saying that honestly, with given the number of things that have to come into being for us to sort of extend and absorb the meat space layer, as you say it, in its totality. Because today we just have, honestly, it seems like we coordinate a lot of our actions through institutions that then say, and then the interaction stops here with the human brain and its various practices amongst the other brains it's coordinating with. We're not really going to kind of extend into what's happening here. We'll do it maybe in this SAP, column here, coordinating with that other one over there. All right. But really the ambition is once we extend it to all forms of ecological and natural capital, not just the fossil fuels and some of the dollars tied to them, we'll then be able to say, what have we learned and how can we adapt those institutions? That's kind of there's kind of like this cycle that feeds in on itself, right? Because you can't just jump in there and say, hey, we have this new form of capital. We have some land over here. We know everything. Let's hit the go button and see what happens with the governance, right? It sounds like you're saying it's got to be an iterative endeavor.
I mean, it would be silly not to say that, right? Like,
of course.
Success is just failure that failed to happen. You look at all these dead coins from the era before 2016. Like, all of those had the potential to become something great. I truly believe that, but they all died because they were failed attempts at doing so. But this sort of like is more of a general principle in my opinion, where we should never punish failure in society. If it's failure with good intent, if it's failure towards outcomes which are socially beneficial or ecologically beneficial, we should attempt to learn from that. And we should reward and be satisfied with the people who went out there and put themselves on the line to move the needle forward. And just sort of as a personal thing, I feel like some of the institutions that exist today, especially in the ivory tower, there has evolved such a culture of critique, such a culture of punishing failure, that it has, you know, muted efforts to overcome very real problems. Sort of theory is a very safe place to be, right? Like theory is comfortable. It's like a warm blanket. Once you put yourself out into the world and you try to change it and you expose yourself to critique, you expose yourself to the interventions of other actors who might not be so pleased that you have gone out of your way to articulate a new future. That is what deserves to be rewarded and respected in our society.
Now, with that in mind, I wanted to hit you with kind of like the last few questions we have here around Colectivo. So I think like you mentioned something in one of your previous talks around carbon tunnel vision. And I feel like this one interesting thing about the project is that it at least purports to eventually address more forms of ecological capital than just carbon, right? And right in this moment in regenerative finance in Web3, it seems everyone is very much focused on carbon markets, voluntary carbon markets, carbon credits. You know, every single thing that can possibly be exhausted in that area now has like 5 to 6 competitors doing something in it. So I wanted to ask you then, with the regenerative finance movement, what are the mistakes yet to be made in how we look at make legible and potentially trade and make financial products out of things that are not carbon?
So carbon was the low-hanging fruit, right? Carbon was the most sort of developed non-crypto markets. Carbon is the narrative, the climate crisis. When you think of climate crisis, you think carbon. Carbon deserves to be the narrative, right? Like we do need to sequester like over a trillion tons of carbon to like reach pre-industrial levels, right? Like, and that should be what we aspire towards, right? So carbon tunnel vision foremost is not an articulation of a rejection of carbon. It's an articulation of carbon and blank. And I just want to make that clear because there is, you know, I have encountered like certain folks who are now like allergic to any sort of carbon conversation, which I don't think should be the case. I think this is a huge problem. It deserves to be addressed. And, you know, addressing this low-hanging fruit early on is having already some really positive outcomes. You know, it's forcing Vera to like rethink what is going on with their registry. It's forcing these traditional actors to go, oh, wow, you know, something is going on here. We should try to improve our standards because we're getting a lot more scrutiny from people we just didn't really expect to be scrutinized by in the first place. You know, yeah. Crypto folks are absolutely, you know, rabid about transparency, right? Like they have such a bias that is different than the traditional horse trading of these types of established institutions. So what does it mean to like move past carbon? Like what are the mistakes we need to make? You know, first, I don't think we have cracked ecosystem services markets. I think we're scratching the surface there. Scratching the surface, like we really need to dive into like, why are these markets being structured the way that they're being structured and why are they failing? And traditional ecosystem services markets, you know, all, not all of them, but many of them are failing. And mm-hmm. For me, it's like the answer is very, very clear. It's you cannot build a market and determine the price of that market's good. These are not compatible, you know, means of doing things. If you want to determine if you want to lock in the price of the good, then you don't have a market for it in the first place. That's just not how it works. So when we are dealing with the tokenization of these types of abstractions, and that is what ecosystem services are, right? On the most radical end of things, you have to think about, okay, how do we tokenize heat? You know, how do we tokenize like really these things, which may in fact be impossible to tokenize? I do think they're impossible to tokenize. For me, the smell test is the tokenization of some ecosystem service, or it is dependent on whether we can intervene and change the ecological state of such a service. If we have no intervention power whatsoever, if there is nothing anyone can do to improve the water quality of a stream, then tokenizing that water quality index, it doesn't mean anything. It's just a sort of a roundabout way of doing finance at the end of the day. So
can we just stay on that for 1 second? And again, you're kind of challenging my thinking in a number of ways, which is great. So earlier in the conversation, you mentioned that capitalism essentially incorporates anything that is a threat to it into its model, right? And that's kind of the power of capitalism. How is tokenization not that? Like what defines, what are the elements of this model that get away from that?
So let's reinterpret this sort of blanket statement of, you know, capitalism is X. capitalism consists of an actor network of institutions, and these institutions have particular, you know, mechanisms that allow them to take these counter-revolutionary movements against them and incorporate them and bring them into themselves. And for me, you know, tokenization in some ways evades this as long as it is moving through new institutions, as long as it is moving through a space, an endogenously developed space, which is not, you know, subject to these same mechanisms. And as long as we can sort of like build both normative and mechanistic distinctions between these new institutions and between the institutions which have historically sort of taken these counter-revolutionary gestures and incorporated them, I think that is the type of articulation that we should be striving for that will accomplish what we want it to.
So, and let me just break that down so that I understand it. So is this about who has control and who has power so that the institutions that we build should be continually renewing themselves with new owners and new contributors, and that the governance and the ownership should effectively, I mean, this is the model of decentralization, right? And the move from a benevolent dictator to more of a decentralized structure. But what I'm trying to understand is like, how does this happen over time in a way that can be scaled such that larger companies will want to be involved in this, right? Because if the competitive dynamic isn't there, then I'm just trying to better understand in this vision where we get out of this paradigm of capitalism kind of incorporating kind of those actors that are trying to push against the
like short-circuiting the dialectic.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I don't know. Maybe after 75 minutes, it's too hard a question and we need to have you back just to kind of tackle that particular question. But it's something that keeps on coming up on this pod. And like, you know, this conversation here, you know, I think is really useful to kind of continue on that particular strand, but it might be a little bit too much for now.
I think I can jam on it really quick. So I wrote this blog post. I did this research about global control networks, you know, trying to answer the question of who, what. And it was really revealing. It was really revealing because the research around this sort of showed that, one, the majority of what is owned is by financial institutions, by banks, essentially. And two, there is a particular sort of like liquidity flow through the global system of ownership that is mediated by this cluster of banks. And these banks also have co-ownership relations in each other. So when you're dealing with a JP Morgan, you're not just dealing with a JP Morgan, you're dealing with a Commerce Bank, you're dealing with a Chase, pardon me, not the same thing, but you have really these co-ownership relations that every bank is actually every other bank. And you have this super nexus, you have this super organism, which really is just, you know, like you can really think of it like an octopus or something, which is moving the liquidity of the world around, you know, absorbing its ownership, its equity, and really sort of like mediating the entire financial system. And for me, like putting a body, putting a topology out there, like understanding this hyperstructure actually really starts to reveal the ways in which we can move away from it. Because once we can sort of draw the contours of our enemy, if you will, then we can really start to look deeper. We can understand its features. We can understand like what's going on structurally, functionally. And, you know, that was what this research was about. And my proposition was that such a super, super entity should exist in Web3 and should be independent from the super entity that exists in legacy finance. And this is, you know, people have these sort of like major critiques on Olympus DAO or Klima DAO or what have you. But going back to what I said about failure, like these platforms, these crypto institutions went forward with this thesis around we're going to have protocol owned liquidity. We're going to you know, buy these crypto assets as much as we can. And they became sort of these sort of like key nodes, these very important nodes from which you look at like Olympus's launch program, a bunch of other nodes emerged around them. And we began to articulate such a complex entity as we might see in something like a group like Toyota. Toyota has something like 170 incorporated entities all around the world. Toyota's top layer is actually seven different corporations that all have co-ownership relations. And if we want to have something which parallels or rivals a Toyota, we have to aspire to that same level of complexity coming from a Web3 native format with Web3 native liquidity and Web3 native ownership relations. And that to me is the articulation of a counter strategy, which could be a feasible counter strategy to this super entity, which is, you know, going out there, incorporating its counter movements, its revolutionary gestures, and sort of muting them from the start.
So if I can kind of go back to the example you used before, when you have one resource and that resource is really simple to understand and you have a good governance and you have a good ownership structure, so, and that's owned by kind of the citizens, you can have these really nice outcomes, right? So you saw this with the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund. The challenge that we have today is ecosystem services, just, and all these other things that we want to manage in a more, we want to steward in a better way, are just too complex to have the scale that we associate with nation states. And so what you're advocating for is essentially a set of almost like concentric circles of local involvement in managing these resources that share kind of an ownership and equity layer between them, such that the system itself is more resilient and has been devolved as much as possible to local actors, because they're the ones that are, that have the best understanding of how to best manage those resources. And those resources are, that it's an abstraction, right? It could be anything. It could be some sort of intangible asset. It doesn't necessarily need to be a natural asset.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think, so there is this principle of subsidiarity, right? Where anything that can be done with local expertise should be done sort of at the most local organizational level when dealing with the management of a commons or socio-ecological system. And when we are talking about these concentric circles, what I am talking about, it has to do with the interfaces. It has to do with the lines between the circles and what is actually moving through these interfaces. What wealth is being transferred out? What wealth is being transferred in? And for something like Klima, we actually can see a very primitive interface structure. In that, you know, there are these bonds being transferred out, there are these assets being transferred in, there is a particular algorithm which mediates the difference between the Klima treasury and everything existing outside of the Klima treasury. And I genuinely think that Web3 can articulate better institutional interfaces that actually form more cohesive concentric structures, because we can really mediate precisely what's moving in and what's moving out from these organizations.
Cool. That's really helpful.
Yeah, I got it. I mean, honestly, with your last little 10 minutes of interchange between you two, I completed the show notes. So they're really rich and awesome. Thank you for that. There's this lovely paper on the network of global corporate control that you reference, your ownership in crypto networks, anti-capture and hyperstructures. So those are all in the show notes for the listeners. Definitely check them out, because I think they go into all of the detail that we might have touched on just in passing here and there through the last 90 minutes or so. And with that, Patrick, I'd like to kick it over to you just for one last bit where we wrap up. Where can folks follow your work online and stay in touch with what you're working on?
So folks can follow the Curve Labs blog. We have a blog on, we have two blogs, actually. We have one on Medium and we have one on Mir. And kind of depending on the nature of the content, we publish in one place or another. You can find all of our blog posts on our website, curvelabs.eu. I occasionally publish through there. I haven't published in a while just because I've been working very, very hard on two projects, mostly. The first is called PrimeDAO. I've been working on DAO-to-DAO relations within PrimeDAO and assisting in the launch of the Prime Deals product, which is a product that exists to allow DAOs to exchange with each other and form these types of complex networks. And then I've been working extensively on Collectivo. So Collectivo, again, is this sort of ReFi experiment. Maybe it's more than an experiment now, because there is a real world network using a community currency that falls within the Collectivo framework in Curaçao today. And now we are iterating on that framework. And you know, that iteration, I'm hoping, will lead to multiple deployments globally by the end of 2023 using such a framework. So keep an eye on Collectivo. You'll see a lot of what I'm working on there, even if my name is not on it personally. And yeah, I think those are the best ways to, maybe my Twitter too. Follow me on Twitter. Obligatory shill. It's Papa, P-A-P-A underscore Raw, R-A-W.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Patrick. That was a nice sort of whirlwind tour through a lot of heady topics that we would like to touch on repeatedly on the show. So appreciate your perspective and thanks for joining us today, man.